The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 5th of August 2020 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up.
It was shocking. So the first thoughts I had that it was an assassination attempt because it was near downtown area Beirut. That's where usually the car bombs where they assassinate political personnel happen. Because I experienced car bombs before here in that area. And usually I see black smoke rising. This time it was pink and light, but it was massive. It's like a volcano.
A huge explosion rocks Beirut, leaving more than 100 people dead and thousands injured. We'll have the very latest from the Lebanese capital. Also ahead, Monocle 24's Marcus Hippie will join us for an update from our headquarters in Zurich. Plus, our medical expert, Dr. Chris Smith, will tell us how his colleagues are designing antibodies that could help tackle COVID-19. And then...
I'm Monocle's Nick Manise, and I'll be talking about bike mares in India and heritage buildings in Melbourne.
Thanks very much, Nick. We'll have much more from him a bit later on. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, we begin today's programme in Lebanon, which is observing a day of mourning following a huge explosion in the capital, Beirut. At least 100 people died in the blast and thousands more are injured. The impact of the explosion could be heard and felt across the Lebanese capital and even shook windows on the island of Cyprus. Monocle 24 contributor Leila Malana Allen spoke to me from Beirut just a few moments ago. Leila, thank you very much for joining us. The explosion happened just after 6 o'clock yesterday. Where were you and what happened to you?
I was in my flat just about a kilometre away from the port where the explosion happened and we heard a loud noise that at the time we thought was some sort of jet or plane flying overhead. I popped up to try and figure out what that was, and just a couple of seconds later, there was a huge white-yellow flash, and essentially the doors and windows all ripped off their hinges, glass flying everywhere, sort of half-thrown, half-jumped into a corner to try and protect myself. And then emerged, ears ringing, went down and found the street full of people all the same. Lots of people covered in blood, lots of flesh wounds and all the windows and doors ripped apart really for around my whole area.
And tell me, you personally, I understand you were injured and I presume a lot of concern for you in the aftermath, contacting friends and people you know in the city. How has your network of friends been impacted?
Almost everyone has had huge damage to their homes. A lot of people end up in hospital with injuries. There were several people missing who we weren't able to find for a while. Thankfully, we have been able to find most people now. So lots of people in various hospitals with various degrees of injuries, and lots of problems with the phone lines and the internet lines going down as well. So very difficult to stay in contact with people throughout last night and this morning.
And finally, just we don't know the exact cause of why this explosion happened. We're hearing, you know, that it was because of these chemicals stored in the port. But what is the mood as people you speak to this morning? Are people still very tense, very concerned about what else might happen in the coming days?
People are incredibly tense. This does seem to be the line now, that it was an explosion caused caused by that in this stockpile, enormous amount of this material that went up. Still unclear whether it was because of a smaller fire that started nearby or welders working in the port, which people are now saying, but most people now do seem to have accepted it, that it was a one-off explosion. There was great concern yesterday that if it was an attack, there could be more like this, but it does seem clear now that that's not the case. So most people now just concerned with trying to get what they can out of their homes and figure out where they're going to sleep and deal with whatever injuries they may have and look for people who are missing.
Leila, thank you so much for joining us. Well, let's get more on the political consequences of the explosion with Lina Khatib, who's the head of the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Lina is originally from Beirut. Welcome back to the briefing, Lina. We're hearing there some of the ideas about what caused this blast, suggestions that it was a huge stock of ammonium nitrate in the port. What are we hearing?
We are indeed hearing that there was a huge quantity, 2,750 tons of ammonium nitrate at the port. Now, the port of Beirut is very close to residential areas in the city. It's not in a remote place where you could store such explosive material. And the material was not even stored safely. The Prime Minister said that ammonium nitrate had been in storage at the port for 6 years, when apparently it was not meant to be there in the first place, because it was confiscated from a ship 6 years ago. I think, you know, any logical person would have a series of questions about such a scenario. Why was this shipment there in the first place? Why was it there for 6 years? Did the government know? Now we know that the government did know that it was there for 6 years. Why did they let it happen? Why was it not stored securely? It's a cocktail of incompetence and corruption that obviously led to the scenario that Lebanon is witnessing today.
In most instances, you'd wonder what the political consequences would be for those in charge. As you say, incompetence, maybe corruption, all sorts of things at play here. But for Lebanon, it's so used to having a political class that's ineffective and corrupt. Do you think there will be any political ramifications for the leaders of the country?
Unfortunately, the leaders of the country have already started hurling accusations at one another as a result of this explosion. So, for example, you have the head of the Customs Authority saying it wasn't the responsibility of the Customs Authority because they had alerted a number of judges in the courts about this shipment of ammonium nitrate a while ago, and that the court system ignored them. And so this is a state in which different entities refuse to admit responsibility for their actions. And the same applies to the politicians in charge of the country. They refuse to admit responsibility for their actions. I think in any decent governance system where such a tragedy to occur, you'd expect to see the government resigning, not in Lebanon. They have not resigned. There have been only one resignation so far of one member of parliament, and that is it. So unfortunately, the politicians in Lebanon think that they can continue to act with impunity. And so far, in the immediate aftermath of this explosion, it doesn't look like this equation is sadly going to change. And of course, this is going to add to popular resentment against the government in Lebanon, because people were already protesting against the government starting in October 2019 because of its incompetence and corruption and because of this deeply flawed political system that allows politicians to be in power and act with impunity. So now popular anger is going to grow exponentially.
We heard from Leila there that, you know, much of the parts of Beirut that outsiders may know, Jemaisi, the neighbourhood for nightlife, Ashrafieh, this incredible, very French Christian neighbourhood, Marmakel, known for its Armenian neighbourhood, all badly, badly hit. What are you hearing about the devastation in those areas?
Well, I mean, I've seen some of the videos and some of my own friends have been injured and some of my family members have also had thankfully only material damage to their property, not just in those areas, but in other areas of Beirut. I mean, the radius around the explosion site extends not just to the areas you mentioned, which are towards the east of the city, but also to the west of the city. So the devastation has been wide-ranging. It was reportedly the explosion heard in Cyprus, across the sea. I mean, people's livelihoods have been damaged as a result of this explosion. Many shops have been completely destroyed, and some people have actually lost their homes. Already, Lebanon had something like 50% unemployment before the explosion happened. With this explosion and with the loss of livelihood for people living in this very large area all around the port, we're going to see even higher unemployment levels. We're going to see more people fall under the poverty line. I mean, again, just before the explosion, the World Bank estimate was 50% of Lebanese would be under the poverty line by the end of 2020. I expect this number is also going to rise right now. So it is not just about the physical devastation. It's also about what it means for people's livelihoods.
And tell me, you know, we think of the Lebanese as, you know, entrepreneurs, as fixers, as people who have had to step up and organize things for themselves because of the failure of local central government. Once again, who will come to help the Lebanese now? There's some suggestions from Paris today that they will be very quick to respond, sending military planes and bringing in as much, you know, as many supplies as they can. Where can Lebanon turn to in this moment?
Well, right now, France has offered essential humanitarian aid. Our Prime Minister in the UK, Boris Johnson, also said that the UK is willing to help in any way it can. Qatar has also sent some aid. The issue is this aid is going to be, of course, very important and necessary in the short term. But in the medium term, Lebanon needs a lot more than that, because it was already devastated economically before this explosion happened. The Lebanese currency, for example, had already lost 80% of its value since last October. The thing is, the economic devastation that Lebanon is witnessing is the result of the corrupt political system in the country. It's a result of politicians assuming positions of power in the government in order to acquire state resources for their own personal benefit rather than to meet the needs of the citizens. And so what Lebanon needs is a package that will support it economically, but that comes with strict conditionality in order to give these politicians who are in power no choice but to engage in necessary reforms, to engage in processes that support transparency and accountability. It is now not clear, you know, whether Lebanon will actually see such a scenario happen. Right now, the only hope, it seems, may come from the IMF, which had already offered Lebanon a loan in return for these reforms. The problem is that the cabinet in Lebanon was not serious about implementing the necessary reforms. So the talks with the IMF just stopped without a result. So perhaps now they can be resurrected. Perhaps the situation now in Lebanon can push these politicians to agree to at least some reforms to rescue the country. Because otherwise, I think we're going to witness a failed state scenario playing out in Lebanon.
Lina, thank you so much for joining us. That was Lina Khatib from Chatham House. Now with a look at the day's other main headlines, here's Monocle's Yaline Goffin.
Thanks, Andrew. Sri Lanka is voting to elect a new parliament. The electorate has been told that they must take masks and pens to the polling booths. Virgin Atlantic has filed for bankruptcy in the United States. It comes as airlines struggle to deal with the fallout from the coronavirus pandemic. Handelsblatt reports that the German car giant BMW is experiencing the worst quarter in its history, but that it is still faring better than its competitors. And today's Monocle Minute takes a closer look at the publishing industry in Brazil. For more on this story, head to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thanks, Yaline. We're going to cross live to Switzerland now for an update from the country's health ministry. Monocle 24's Marcus Hippe joins me on the line from our headquarters in Zurich. Marcus, we're hearing that whatever lies ahead for other countries, that the Swiss are saying it's unlikely there'll be any new restrictions for COVID.
Exactly. To give you a bit of background, a bit of context, it's been a bit of a difficult week for the Federal Office of Public Health in this country. A bit earlier this week, they had to actually correct something they had said out in public all earlier. Earlier, they were claiming that the risk of contracting COVID-19 was greatest in clubs and restaurants. And then earlier this week, they had to come out and just say that actually that information was wrong. They had made a mistake. And actually, people most often catch COVID-19 from their family members simply at homes. So now after that, there's been, you know, this doesn't sound like a major mistake if it came from many other countries, but obviously here in Switzerland, people are very punctual and questioning what is going on at the health ministry. And we've been hearing from the health minister, Alain Berset, now, who has been giving quite a few interviews saying openly that they made a mistake and they're trying to do their best. And at the same time, he's given us a pretty good idea of what to expect from the future. I believe we are seeing a charm offensive in a way, dare I say, now he's trying to create more trust in this nation to what him and his team are doing at the moment. So in any case, what we have been hearing now, on one hand, he's raising concerns that COVID-19 figures are slowly increasing in this country, and he's thinking that the Swiss people are becoming a bit too careless. For example, in one of the interviews, he said that there are people who are shaking hands again, and that is a big mistake. But at the same time, he is creating trust in future. For example, he's saying that there's no need for much stricter restrictions at the moment. And what is also interesting is that he's saying that if there is a second wave of the virus taking place in this country a bit later, they most likely won't need blanket measures. So they don't need to shut down the country the same way they did in March. Instead, they can have a more nuanced approach, a more differentiated approach to a possible second wave by just focusing on different measures in different parts of the country.
Marcus, can I ask you, you're originally from Finland, a country which has also taken clear messages to the people, has had, you know, strictures put in place very early on that it's stuck to. Do you think there's something about being in these smaller, cohesive societies that allows you to be nimble when it comes to dealing with COVID-19, easier to get everybody following the same line, buying into the message, than if you're in a country that's got, you know, maybe 50, 60 million people, much richer backgrounds, much diverse stories, where it's perhaps more complicated to bring everyone along on exactly the same narrative?
I think that's a really, really good question. I don't know. I think it's a very, very complicated question you're asking at the same time. In a way, I think it's probably simpler in smaller countries. I guess you are at least partly right when you ask if it's easier to bring smaller nations together. If I look at what's been happening in Switzerland and what's been happening in Finland, like, you know, what these countries are sharing is that the message you've been getting from the government has been very almost predictable. It's been extremely logical. It's been rational. And that's been something that people have found quite easy to believe in and actually follow and obey. And I feel like in many bigger countries, first of all, I guess it's about political systems even as well. You know, sometimes you're wondering why these people actually have got into these positions. Are they there because they are qualified and because they know what they are doing, or if there are other reasons behind? But I think it's interesting that both in Finland and in Switzerland, what people say about their governments is that they believe in them and they believe that their leaders have done a great job. And for example, in the UK, that is something I don't hear from many people at all.
Well, Marcus, thank you. That was Monocle's man in Zurich at the moment, Marcus Hippe. The briefing is brought to you in association with Allianz.
As part of the programme's partnership with Allianz, we are bringing you stories that demonstrate Allianz's commitment to securing people's lives. After all, Allianz has been working hard to do just that, to give courage to its customers for what's ahead. Because Allianz knows how important it is to have a fair partner at your side. Stay tuned to the briefing to hear exactly how Allianz does it. And Allianz, for life.
You're back with the briefing on Monocle 24. I'm Andrew Tuck. Marcus was just providing us with an update on the Swiss Health Ministry's plans to tackle COVID-19. But how are the world's scientists getting on in their bid to stamp out the virus? I'm joined now by Monocle 24's medical expert, Dr. Chris Smith. Chris is also a consultant virologist at Cambridge University. Chris, let's start by asking you about something called designer antibodies. What are these and why are they important?
One way in which we can combat infectious diseases is with antibodies. Now, people have probably come across this in a number of different settings. Outside of the coronavirus situation, for many years, we've treated a range of disorders by actually getting antibodies from people that are immune to a certain thing, purifying them, and then giving those antibodies to a person who's either at risk of catching that thing or has got that thing and at risk of becoming severely unwell. Really good examples of this include hepatitis B, a virus that can damage the liver. In the vast majority of people, it causes a liver infection that is self-limiting, so it goes away and you become immune to it. But if a young child catches hepatitis B, they can get chronic liver disease for life, and they'll go on to get cirrhosis, liver failure, liver cancer. They may need a transplant. We can stop that if we give them a dose of antibodies very early on after they're born, and this mops up any virus they may have encountered from their mum, who is the source of the infection, and that protects them. Same with a pregnant woman who's exposed to chickenpox and has never had chickenpox. Chickenpox in pregnancy can be devastating for the mother's health, so we give a dose of antibodies, or at least we did before we had other drugs we could use as well. Again, this reduces the mortality rate very significantly. We're seeing with coronavirus, people are trying this age-old thing that was first born in the 1920s and late 1919s for the Spanish flu pandemic. People would take the serum, the plasma, from patients who had recovered from the disorder and give it to people who were at risk of or were suffering with the disorder, the rationale being the people who have recovered have made some kind of factor in their bloodstream which can be transferred to a third party and will confer protection for them. We now know that what they were doing when they were getting success with those measures was transferring antibodies. Come forward to the present day, because we now understand the antibody science a lot more, we can actually design antibodies. Rather than wait for the immune system to do it, we can actually design our own antibodies, or we can actually provoke the production of antibodies that we want. We can produce them in massive amounts, and then we can concentrate them and give them in the same way as you give an injectable drug, which means that they go around in the bloodstream, and if a person then encounters the thing that antibody has been programmed to fight off, they are protected so-called passively for the time that they have those antibodies in circulation, which is a matter of weeks.
And how far advanced is this research?
Well, we've been doing this for a very long time, because some of the early cancer treatments, for example, we've been able to make antibodies which recognize specific markers on cancer cells and can be used to deliver so-called magic bullets, so that you can target your chemotherapy just to where it's needed and you mitigate against getting side effects of chemotherapy having off-target effects around the body. So this, in some respects, the science is not new, but the application is. The problem is that it's very, very expensive. And the reason it's very, very expensive is that when you make these antibodies synthetically, the process is tricky, it's very specialized, and to do it at scale is very difficult, because you've got to produce cells that can produce antibodies, and that means you've then got to incubate those cells in very expensive incubation facilities, all kind of observing, you know, pristine hygiene and so on, to get something which has been manufactured safely. To do this at the scale that we would need it is very, very difficult to do, which is why it's not routinely used to combat a range of infections. It also involves injecting the antibodies. That's why people favour, if we can, as a protective measure, giving people a vaccine, which then teaches your body how to make its own antibodies. That's not to say, though, that under certain circumstances, these sorts of technologies are very, very powerful for people who need something. So small numbers of people with a very specialist need, you can treat infections like this.
Now, Chris, to a question which I've asked you every single week that I think I've had you on the show, and apologies for asking yet again, the vaccine. So we hear stories in the last couple of weeks that the Russians and the Chinese say they're going to start vaccination programs as early as October. We hear Donald Trump suggesting that they won't be that far behind. Is this fanciful? Is this likely? And what progress are you hearing that's happening?
Well, the world has united behind the effort to create a coronavirus vaccine. There have been hundreds of projects initiated to develop a whole raft of different sorts of vaccines. And that's a really good thing, because it's not a case of one size fits all here. There will be different indications for different groups of people. The sort of vaccine that might be useful to launch at scale in a first world country like the UK is a very different sort of beast than the kind of vaccine that will work best in the settings of a resource poor nation where there's no fridge to keep something cold, so you need vaccines that will be stable at jungle temperatures, for example, and can be easily administered in the field. So that's why it's very important to have a range of different vaccines. There are now more than, I think there's close to 23 or 24 projects actually in clinical trials now, which means there are actually needles going into people and those people are being followed up. That's very encouraging. But remember, the failure rate for any kind of medical intervention, the pharmaceutical industry works on an anticipated failure rate of 90%. So 9 times out of 10, they acknowledge that it's not going to work. So the more projects we have going, the more likely it is we're going to get a success story. In the UK, I think we've got two of the world leaders at the moment here, two projects which are likely to be very successful, three if you count some of the other initiatives that are also beginning to catch up now. So I think we're in a really good place in the UK. And of course, once the point is proven, it'll be a question of just scaling that across the world. But that just is a big assumption that we can, because there are nearly 8 billion people on Earth, and they may need more than one dose of this. So that would be making 16 billion doses of whatever vaccine we come up with in a hurry. And that's a tall order for anybody.
But still, just in a couple of words, by year end, you're feeling, do you think that ordinary British citizens might be getting a jab or an injection to vaccinate them?
We'll definitely have a vaccine by then. The question we won't know the answer to is this actually going to work? And that's the problem, because we don't want to put all our eggs in one immunological basket, because if we're going to spend big and then do a big campaign to vaccinate people, we need to know it's going to work. And that's the thing that's going to be sorely missing, unfortunately, because the vaccine trials we do test whether the vaccine works before they give it to loads of people. We're robbed of time. We're time poor with this. We don't have the opportunity to get that sort of data. So we're going to have to do a leap of faith. I'm pretty confident we'll have a vaccine. Whether or not it's going to give us long-term protection, though, or whether we're going to be back to square one and having to do it every winter, that I'm not so sure about.
Well, Chris, thank you very much. That was our health and science correspondent, Dr. Chris Smith, and you're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's programme, Monocle's Nick Manise has just joined me in the studio, which can only mean one thing. It's the urbanism roundup. Welcome back to The Briefing, Nick. We're going to start with Mumbai's bicycle councillors. Why are they getting on their bikes?
Well, I mean, like most cities around the world, Mumbai has started rolling out pop-up bike lanes to accommodate. I mean, they've seen a huge increase in the number of bike riders as people sort of shirk public transport during the pandemic. But the city's taking it one step further than pop-up bike lanes. They are going to install in positions of, I guess, influence in city council, councillors for its 24 wards who are going to advocate for cycling, which is really exciting. So they're going to be negotiating with stakeholders like local businesses, other civic authorities, NGOs, schools and colleges to, I guess, help the rollout of bike lanes and bike infrastructure in the city. And they'll be looking at helping to set up docks for bikes, for people to pick them up from train stations, and even setting up training zones in parts of the city for people that aren't perhaps confident on their bikes and want to learn.
But a bit of a backlash in Montreal in some places over the provision of bicycle lanes.
Yeah, and maybe this is a city that actually could have used some bicycle councillors, because to me it seems like there's been a little bit of a breakdown in communication in Montreal, or at least certainly in terms of engagement with the local communities. Like I said, they're rolling out temporary bike lanes as many cities are, but a stretch in Montreal on I believe it's Notre Dame Street, Notre Dame Sangam Street West, outside a few venerable restaurants and establishments, has received some backlash from the restaurant owners there. And actually, within 24 hours, the city had rolled back their plans to install the temporary bike lane. It had been installed, removed the temporary bike lane. I think, for me here, the thing that's interesting about this story is clearly there wasn't enough consultation, and perhaps the solution that they proposed wasn't necessarily suitable for that part of the city, which clearly is relying on people, the reality of it is that lots of people in the city still need to be able to drive their cars and drive to these restaurants, and perhaps a better solution that balanced bike lanes with car parking might have served the solution better.
Now, it's a side point, and we can't really debate it now, but I cycle to work most days, and certainly did today. But coming through London, I think that some of the provision of, you know, temporary bike lanes in London is just chaotic and annoying. It's like if I was, I recognise that some people need to get a taxi, and some people need to drive through the city on a car, and some of the ways that they've been put in on major roads is just causing gridlock for cars, and then the lanes are not being used by cyclists because everyone's sitting at home. So it's I don't know. I think that this idea that it's always, you know, bike good, car bad needs a bit of a debate. So, well, good for Montreal for having the debate anyway. Oh, here's a surprise. Here's a story from Australia. Well, here we go. Melbourne, 100 buildings being listed for protection. What kinds of things do you need to protect in Melbourne?
I mean, okay, just for starters, not my home city. If it's Perth, it's surprising and suspicious. But no, this Melbourne, this is significant. They've just wrapped up their review of the HODL grid, so the central streets of Melbourne. And essentially an independent review looked at 1,000 buildings in the city centre for protection. They've picked 137 significant ones that should be protected. That they include 1920s department buildings, Chicago-esque office buildings, and plenty from the post-war period. There's a post office, a cinema, a women's club, a telephone exchange, and I think it's a really nice celebration of that built heritage in Melbourne. And it's not necessarily. I think there's this view perhaps that heritage protection is, might stop development or hinder it in some ways, but I actually view it as the opposite. In knowing what we've got to work with and what has been decided is significant and should be protected, it actually gives developers and architects and designers the opportunity to build upon that heritage and add new layers and new stories to the city's architectural history.
Thank you very much, Nick. We always imagine that Nick is trying to get some gong from the Australian government with the number of Aussie stories he slips in. But anyway, thanks for joining us on the show. But that's all we have for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James and Eileen Goffin, and the researcher was Charlie Fillmore-Court, and our studio manager was Maylee Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I'm Andrew Tuck. Goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.